I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2405.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I think we are pretty much aware of what this bill is. The measure prohibits the regulation of rates, terms, and services for a service or entry into the market of voice over internet protocol or internet protocol related services. We've had to carry over this bill because of waiting for the fiscal and revenue analysis, in which we have both. There is a minimal fiscal impact with the Dash 9 amendment that's being put in front of us, and there was a revenue statement that was issued on the amendment.
And we have some nice people here today who are going to come up and give some brief testimony. Andrea Fogue, Brenda Wilson, and Jeff Wassenet, please. And just for everyone, we are going to, if we have a motion and the votes, move the Dash 9s. So that's what we're discussing today. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Andrea Fogue with the League of Oregon Cities. So the League's position has not changed on this bill. The League opposes House Bill 2405. The Dash 9 amendments do not adequately address franchise and rights-of-way issue. As you heard, there is a revenue impact to those franchisees, to taxes, existing taxes. So we would ask your no vote on this bill. At one point, we talked about Dash 11 amendments. Those 11 amendments, if in fact you want to pass this bill, go much further to addressing our concerns. The bottom line really is, as long as internet-enabled protocol services continue to be included in any way in the bill, that does not adequately address our concerns. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Chair Schaffler, Vice Chairs Barton, and Cameron, for the record again, my name is Brenda Wilson. I'm here on behalf of the City of Eugene, and I appreciate the opportunity to present testimony for you today. As you see, I have presented you with a letter from Harang Long, Gary, and Rudnick, signed by Sharon Rudnick, who is currently the lead attorney in the case that we have ongoing and pending with Verizon at this particular moment. I'd also like to send the apologies of Mayor Kitty Piercy, who had hoped to be here today to testify in opposition to this bill. However, our mayor and city council are on break. Harang Long, Gary Rudnick have been our attorneys on all six of our telecom cases over the past 12 years. These are very complex cases, and as we present, as you saw in the report that we presented to you, these cases cost approximately $500,000 apiece. We've already spent over $100,000 on the case that we are currently involved in. We've won the other four cases. Sharon Rudnick reviewed House Bill 2405 along with the Dash 9 amendments. They believe that not only do the Dash 9 amendments not adequately protect our interests and our authority to charge the taxes and fees, but they actually could impact the outcome of this case. And you have her letter written to the mayor asking the mayor to step in and protect our interests in this case and our authority to charge the franchise fees and the taxes. And I won't read it for you. And I would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Jeff. Go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon, representing residential ratepayers. Just wanted to put on the record that the Dash 9 amendments, in our opinion, for House Bill 2405 do not protect consumers, do not protect the now infamous Aunt Millie, and therefore we oppose the bill. Thank you.
Any questions of these good people? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Have a good weekend. Jim, you want to come and talk on this briefly? Mr. Austin? Good morning.
Good morning. Permission to use a visual aid?
No.
No?
Come on, sit down, let's talk.
No visual aid?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, thank you.
Anybody else want to speak to this bill this morning? If so, come on up right now.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Mr. Austin.
Again, Jim Austin from Clackamas County, still in opposition to 2405. Again, following the testimony of some of the other folks here, we don't feel that the Dash 9 amendments are adequate to protect the future of franchise fees or consumer protections with regard to cable franchises. And I know that there's been a lot of discussion about protecting the status quo, and the status quo is cable video as delivered by cable. But the future, in the near future, of course, is delivering that service over an internet protocol-enabled service. Again, if I may. So, I'll be as quickly as possible. So right now we have data, video, and voice services that are delivered, represented by these three nuts. And along with that are...
The Ms. Nuts, right?
Yeah. And along with that come with come consumer protections and then franchise fees and rights of ways. And what Verizon has asked for is a void bill. And what they're actually getting is something called Internet Protocol Enabled Service, which actually includes VoIP. And in the future, voice, data, and video will all be delivered under that. And, of course, our concern is when that happens, consumer protection and the franchise fees and the utility rights of ways are left out. And in some places, I think that's already being delivered right now. And as the case is, and there's cases about whether or not cable is cable. So I'm just worried about muddying the waters in the future. And I urge your no vote on this or adopt some amendments that limit it to VoIP. Thank you.
Thank you for that visual clarification, Mr. Austin.
Thank you. Now
very valuable.
Now I can see, Mr. Austin. Thank
any
you.
Other questions? Now I can any questions for this fine young man who we all respect greatly.
Mr. Chair, yeah. If I may?
Yes, of course.
Where is the satellite service in that scenario you just put up for us?
Well, we currently don't regulate Internet service right now. And
thank you.
Okay.
Any further questions, Mr. Austin? Representative Polvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to clarify, since we don't regulate, the Internet right now, how does that scenario or how does this bill essentially impact the services that are being provided through Hardwire right now?
Which services?
Oh, cable or hardline phone, say a portion of the system becomes Internet-enabled protocol service, and why would you lose consumer protection and franchise fees at that point?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Polvey, because and as the litigation that's going on around the states suggests, it muddies the water between when is cable service no longer service. Even though it's the same programming, provides the same benefits to customers, just delivered via a different mechanism. They're still using rights of ways to put the hardware in the ground, but at the point it becomes an Internet protocol enabled service delivered as such, we would lose any ability under that scenario to regulate it or charge franchise fees or do consumer protection programs.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
So at that point when they implement part of the system with Internet-enabled protocol service, the what you're saying is, as an example with the franchise fees, the rights of ways and the hard lines that are connected up to an Internet-enabled protocol service at some point basically takes those regulations away from that entire system.
Correct. That's our concern.
Thank you.
Thank you for the questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Have a good weekend.
I don't have 25 copies of this, so.
You're doing great. All righty.
Anyone else want to testify on House Bill 2405?
All right. I'm going to close the public hearing. House Bill 2405, open work session. Representative Cameron.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the dash nines to House Bill 2405.
Representative Cameron moves dash nine amendments in House Bill 2405. Is there any discussion on the amendment, on the motion? Representative Holby, then Representative Barton.
Mr. Chair, I will be a no on this amendment. I do have great concerns about the franchise fees and the consumer protections, as you know. Good people can disagree on this, but I'm really concerned about the ramifications of this bill and really don't understand why we need this bill for any kind of future investment or anything else. The bill just doesn't make sense to me. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe the Dash 9 amendments will improve the underlying bill, which I gather is moving out today, such that I'm prepared to support the amendments, although I still plan to vote no on the bill as amended. I actually have one, I suppose, comment or suggestion to the proponents of the bill. The Dash 9 amendments, Section 3H has caused the opponents some consternation. And specifically Ms. Wilson from the City of Eugene, I think it could be removed. Frankly, I don't think that the Section 3H which discusses that this bill should not be construed to authorize any state to do something which is preempted. That's kind of a tautological statement. Obviously, the state can't authorize something that's preempted by federal law. If you guys would feel comfortable perhaps removing that on the Senate side, I just think it's one less worry to the opponents of this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Witt, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since this amendment may adversely impact a case that the City of Eugene has before it currently, I will be a no on it.
Thank you, Representative. Any further discussion? Representative Edwards.
Thank you. I said my piece at the last hearing. My position hasn't essentially changed, or hasn't changed. I appreciate the City of Eugene bringing forth the letter from their legal counsel. It says in the letter that they appreciate the provision of the proposed amendments. However, when the amendments are read in conjunction with the subsequent subsection, which states, notwithstanding any other provision of law, the state and local governments may not regulate VoIP and IP-enabled services, we believe the amendments would essentially be rendered null because they would be encompassed within the notwithstanding any other provision of law language of subsection 2. So, in my reading, I mean, I think that that's clearly not the intent of either the proponents or the language of this bill. And I think it would be an act of bad faith on the part of the proponents of this bill, and I want them to know that, if they were to try to pull this. And I would, as a legislator, essentially feel duped, and I will be back here next session to write the language to undo what they've done if they were to try to not to use this law to not pay franchise fees. So,
and I'll be right here with him. Thank you, Representative Esper.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and hopefully I would be the third one here because I'm going to support this bill because of what I hear from the people that oppose it. I worry. I have concern. Nothing real concrete. Of course, how can you have anything concrete when you don't even know what you don't even know about what you're regulating? So, consequently, I am going to be a yes vote. But I will let people know. I will be one of the co-sponsors of the bill that will have the hammer if anything is taken astray from this bill.
Thank you. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of comments. I'll be supporting the Dash 9 amendments. You know, comment was made that it doesn't provide for consumer protection because it doesn't explicitly put the PUC in charge. I think we had testimony from the PUC that they accept complaints and concerns from all citizens, and they look into them. And because of their position of authority, they have a lot of ability to help consumers with complaints. And also, we become the court of last resort if I think there are several of us that are prepared next session to look at doing something if this thing seems to be going awry. I guess the second thing is I had a fascinating conversation with Ms. Walker, who has done some terrific work for Clackamas County and worked with me in the past and on behalf of the Counties and the Cities Association. And I guess the upshot of that discussion is I don't know how to regulate and tax what doesn't currently exist. And I just think to attempt to do that is also laced with failure and likely unexpected consequences. So are unanticipated. So I think at the moment we ought to stick with where we are. I'm very concerned about franchise fees, and as a former local official, I think I understand that pretty darn well. But I think at the moment this is a prudent step, and I support it.
Any further? Thank you, Representative. Any further comments? Clerk will call a roll, please.
On the dash.
Representative Kenmer.
Aye.
Representative Colby.
No.
Representative Escobar.
Aye.
Representative Vice Chair Barton.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Edwards.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Excuse
me. Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
No.
All right. Motion carries. Representative Cameron.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2405 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves House Bill 2405 floor as amended to due pass recommendation. Comments? Discussion? Representative Wynn.
Mr. Chairman, I'll be a no on the bill as well. We've had heard opposition from CUB in the interests of consumers of the state. We've had opposition from the cities and the counties, from the Communication Workers of America, who are the workers in this industry, and the Public Utility Commission. Mr. Chairman, I can see no grounds why anybody could vote for this bill, and I'm afraid that, somewhere down the line when consumers are adversely impacted by this, we can look back to today's action and know that deregulation, as far as I'm concerned, was wrong when Alfred Kahn started it under the Carter administration, and it hasn't gotten any better since. I'll be a no.
Thank you, Representative. Any further comments?
Mr. Chairman,
yes,
just a point of clarification. I don't believe this is deregulation. This is not moving forward with regulation.
I believe you're exactly right, Representative. Any further comments? Thank you very much. Clerk, call the roll. Oh, Representative Holy, forgive me. Do not call the roll. We're getting there, though.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to echo Representative Witt's comments. And the notion that this isn't deregulation is, or regulation, I think, is, not really the main issue of this. But, it seems to keep coming up. And the fact is that we have hard lines out there that provide basic lines to people, and with this bill going through, those basic lines become deregulated once they get hooked up to any kind of internet-enabled protocol service. So I don't know, if you don't want to call it deregulation, I suppose you could call it a lack of future service that now exists today. And in those basic lines also, we have consumer protections attached to that for billing issues, for all sorts of service issues. So we do have that in place for basic lines. And, quite frankly, I just don't understand why we need this bill. It just seems kind of out there in internet cyberspace, I guess. Thank you.
There's a lot of things this session out there in the internet cyberspace. I will not deny that comment. But for any further comments or discussion, Tamison, would you please call the roll?
Representative Penimer.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
No.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Vice Chair Martin.
No.
Vice Chair Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Edwards.
Aye.
Representative
Matthews.
Excuse. Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
No.
Chair Schaffler.
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Edwards will carry the bill on the floor. Closed work session, House Bill 2405. House Bill 2699 will be
Thank
carried
you,
over until next week.
Time
to be announced. And I'm going to open a public hearing, House Bill 3122.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 3122 allows an Oregon Liquor Control Commission full on-premises sales or limited on-premises sales licensee to obtain upon the health inspection or reinspection of the premises verification of the capacity of pint glasses used for draught malt beverages. The measure allows a licensee to obtain a display sticker from the OLCC if the glasses hold a pint of malt beverage under standard conditions, and also allows DHS to charge a fee for the verification and for the OLCC to charge a fee for the decal not to exceed the cost of providing the service. You have in front of you a -1 amendment that clarifies that the glasses used at the premises for serving malt beverages have to be capable of holding at least 16 ounces when dispensed under standard conditions.
Thank you, Teresa. We have Representative Bailey with us. And Evan Manuel, would you like to come up too, please?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir, Representative.
After many hours of discussions of House Bill 2405, I think we could use a full 16 ounces.
Amen. I will vote for that motion, Representative.
Will you buy?
If he won't, I will.
Second.
Representative, please, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I think Representative Barton just said my testimony. So. I appreciate the opportunity to bring one of the most critical bills of the session in front of you. House Bill 3122, also known as the Honest Pint Act. The Honest Pint Act has been brought forward to ensure that we have a way for establishments that are serving a full 16 ounces or more in their pints to market that, to tell their consumers that this is a trustworthy establishment, to post that in a clear place where people can see it, and to attract business to their establishment. This bill is not intended to be heavy-handed regulation. What it is more of an opportunity for places that are engaging in this kind of behavior and serving a full 16 ounces or more to be able to show that to their consumers and to demonstrate that. What this is, the Honest Pint Act, is intended to address, there is a perception out there that there are some establishments that are serving a quote-unquote pint in a what's commonly referred to as a cheater pint. So the thickness of the base of the glass, the width of the top, makes it very difficult to determine whether or not a pint glass actually contains a full 16 ounces. Obviously, there are pints come in different sizes. There are some places that use imperial pints, which are more than 16 ounces. That's why we've limited this. We've said in the bill that this is at least 16 ounces so that we can account for imperial pints. This bill allows, during the course of a normal inspection of the premises, a determination to be made through a random sample if the establishment requests, and we emphasize this is a voluntary request, they can request to have their glasses measured, and if they meet the measurement requirements, they are issued a certificate that then they can deliver to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, which will then issue them a sticker that they can put in their window that says Certified Honest Pint Establishment. Again, they can request the measurements, they can request the sticker, and if they choose to do it, they can then they will pay the cost of that program so that we're not burdening taxpayer dollars with this program. So I think this is a bill that hopefully provide a little bit of enjoyment in people's lives in a downtime. And Representative Burton, I think you summed up some of the sentiments here as well after a long week. So I urge your support and would be happy to take any questions. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Sorry, I forgot one thing. There's also a -1 amendment in front of you. The -1 amendment is intended to clarify the intention of the bill with respect to measuring the amount of liquid such that we can account for any foam at the top of the beer. in the glass. I think I just saw how many pairs of eyes rolled.
Representative Bard.
Thank you. Representative Bailey, I don't know if you read the Oregonian today, but I'm surprised your bill didn't make it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Burton, I don't recall the article. Was it one about best bills of the session?
That's
that,
right.
Was that the article?
I'm honored to be a co-sponsor, Representative.
I appreciate you bringing this consumer protection bill before this committee. Because the consumer is always at the top of our priority list in this committee.
In
everything that's purchased in this state, whether it be beer or telecommunications or internet service. But Mr. Manuel, please.
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, Evan Manvel for the record. I've submitted detailed written testimony, but I won't go over. And I'm not the only one who enjoys a great Oregon beer. I live within 2 miles of 5 breweries. The Facebook group that I set up to support this bill has 415 members. So they're not all here. They're probably having a beer. But there is a lot of support for this bill. Difficult times deserve an honest pint. And the Bible itself in Leviticus 19:36 says, "You shall have just balances, just weights, a just ephah, and a just hin." This is biblically important to be honest to folks. Now, if I were in charge, would make serving cheater pints a Measure 11 offense. But I'm not in charge, and these are difficult budget times. We do not want to fill our prisons. So I urge your support for 3122 with the -1 amendment. Thank you for your time.
Oh, I appreciate that. Any questions? Representative Ford.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just as much as you've mentioned the consumer protection aspects of this beer, I do have some concerns that you're allowing pints to actually be bigger than a pint. And so and the way I read the bill, you could have a much 20-ounce pint or a 24-ounce pint, according to this bill. And as one who likes to measure how much they drink, that could be very misleading. So I think there is a pause for concern here that I could be getting twice as many pints as I thought I was getting.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's a very valid point, actually, we want to make sure that people that are trying to limit and control how much they're consuming do have the opportunity to be able to do that. The way this bill is structured has done so because there are different ways of that people market a pint from 16 ounces or more for imperial pints. So we want to make sure that we're allowing for places that do have glasses that exceed that amount because of the way that they're marketing their beers to be able to continue to do that. But we want to make sure that they're not doing less than that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Confirmation that this won't cost the taxpayers a single dime. And why OLCC instead of another agency?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the intention of this bill, and my understanding as it's gone forward as written by Legislative Council, is that this will not cost taxpayer dollars. It is written in such a way that the establishment that requests the designation as an honest pint establishment will pay the full costs of the program, which are intended to be negligible. So it'll be a small fee to cover the incremental cost and then hold the taxpayers harmless on this. And again, it is a voluntary bill. To the second part of your question about why the OLCC, in conversations with Legislative Council, and it's not my area of expertise on restaurant regulation, my understanding is that the inspections are not done by OLCC. They are done by DHS, or a subsection of DHS, that will make the determination about whether or not the glasses are certified during the normal course of a normal inspection. So it's not an extra deal for them to go out there. And then they get a certificate that they can submit to OLCC, which does the regulation of the premises and the liquor license and that sort of thing.
Yes, sir.
That's why I asked. I didn't want to be creating more trips for an agency that may or may not have business in a restaurant when there's another agency that's already out there and on premises. So that's why.
Mr. Chair,
that's why I asked.
Representative Edwards, that's exactly the intention, is that no agency will have to do an extra trip or more than what they're already doing here.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Cameron. Cameron, please.
Representative, have you had any discussions with OLCC to see if they might be interested in having something like a voluntary program or something like this? I'm having pause about regulating this, and frankly, I've noted that it's interesting the size of those, the thickness in the bottom of those glasses. I think a lot of us consumers have noticed that, but on the other hand, I'm just having pause about supporting such a law.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kimmer, the point is very well taken, and I've received a number of comments of why is legislation needed on this as opposed to just a rulemaking action, and the answer is that actually relates back to Representative Edwards' question, in that OLCC doesn't do inspection of premises, and yet they would be the ones that would need to issue this certification. So we need to set up a way for DHS and OLCC to be able to coordinate to have a program that doesn't require anybody to do anything more than much more than what they're already doing. So it's that coordination between the two bodies for the health and safety inspection to connect to OLCC. And but I stress in your comments that this is a voluntary program for the restaurant. It's not. I would respectfully not characterize it as a regulation, as opposed to a setting up what I see as really a marketing opportunity for a lot of these businesses. I imagine having a fun sticker and that goes in the window, and people can look and say, "Hey, it's an honest pint shop," and go on in.
Chair Schaffler, Representative, if I may add, just the government does certify that when we get a gallon of gas, it's an actual gallon of gas. When we buy fruits and vegetables at the grocery store, that the weights are calibrated and that sort of thing. And so having a government certification, an optional one, of the size of a pint seems like a reasonable thing to do.
Optional, not mandatory. You want to advertise this? Consumer comes in with their 16-ounce glass, fills up the business's pint with water, pours it into their 16-ounce glass. Real easy to check. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I checked with our industry on this bill, and they don't have any objections to this bill. But I, as a representative of my constituents, I am concerned. So what this bill does... It says DHS here, but DHS delegates to local county health departments. So county health departments, which are stretched to the limit today, this is a mandate to them, the way I understand this bill, that if they come in, if I own a bar or a tavern, I have to say to them, hey, I want this honest pint inspection done. So it's one more thing that our county health inspector would have to do. And it can only be, what I understand is this can only be done upon their normal inspection. I can't call the county health department and say, can you come out here and give me an honest pint inspection? Is that the way I'm reading this bill?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Cameron, that's my understanding of the bill as well, is that they cannot call and request a special honest pint inspection, and that is intended to reduce the burden on the county health departments. It is a mandate on the county health departments that they have the ability to offer this during the normal course if requested, but it is not an unfunded mandate in the sense that it is written into the bill that the establishment requesting it shall pay for the divided cost of the program. So we are asking the county health departments, which are absolutely stretched thin, and we're asking them to do a lot. We're asking them to have the capacity to do one more thing, but we're including within the program a way to pay for that.
Okay, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Please.
Some establishments, because of their good health inspections, are only inspected once a year. So my competitor next to me, right down the street, is inspected tomorrow, but I don't get inspected for the next 12 months. My competitor is allowed to put up an honest pint certificate. I got to wait a whole year to get mine. Is that the way I read this bill?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Cameron, that would be also my understanding of the way this bill is written currently. One possible way that we might be able to remedy that is to have some sort of process by which you could say that you're in the process of applying for it. But I would hesitate to have a process that would allow for more of a burden on the county health departments to make them do something that they're not already in the process of doing.
Thank you.
Representative Esquivel, then.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you go in and I don't drink beer. I don't drink alcohol. But do you go in and ask for a 16-ouncer? Is that the thing is, and then you get a smaller amount? Is that what you do?
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Or you just go in and say, hey, give me a beer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, it is... I can't speak for everybody, but for myself and for many of the people I've seen, you often ask for a pint, and a pint in the United States is 16 ounces, and so you are expecting to get 16 ounces in a pint, and they're often marketed as pints, so there is an implication that there is a full 16 ounces, as opposed to a glass, which is often 12 ounces. So there is a, both in their communication to the customer, as well as in the customer's communication to them, in both directions, there is an implication that the beverage to be served will be 16 ounces.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm pretty naive. I don't understand how it works.
I've spent a lot of time studying this concept. I think we should amend it to say it has to be fresh and cold, too. So, anyway, any further questions to these fine Americans? We are not moving the bill today. We don't have the paperwork, the fiscal to do it. But I appreciate this, and I intend to move it if we have votes. Any
Thanks
thank
for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Have a good weekend.
So are we going to amend it to include fresh and cold?
No, Representative Lear.
Because you might have my support.
Well, we can discuss that over a pint. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3122, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2890.
All right, Mr. Chair. That's all right. I called outside. Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2890 establishes a definition of employee for the purposes of classification of workers. The measure establishes the crime of misclassification of an employee and imposes civil penalties and criminal sanctions for certain types of violations. The measure also authorizes debarment and imposition of stop work orders against certain violators, prohibits discrimination against an individual that's exercising rights established under this measure. There is an emergency clause on the bill effective upon passage.
I'm going to call my friends Lynn Lear back and Bob Russell up to talk to us about this. Morning, Lynn. Whenever you're ready.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here and speak in favor of House Bill 2890. My name is Lynn Lerbach. I'm a representative of the Joint Council of Teamsters, representing approximately 30,000 people across the great state of Oregon. Mr. Chairman, I come here with today with kind of a troubled heart. You know, this is no longer the country or the state that I grew up in. What the hell has happened to honesty, integrity, fairness? I think it's been replaced with scamming, gaming, and scheming. All we have to do is look at what the banksters have done to this country. And your comment on deregulation, we deregulated banking, and what happened? Scheming, gaming, and now this whole country is in a financial mess. And we reward that? I think we have to look at it hard. Right here in Oregon, we've got gaming, scheming, cheating going on in the misclassification of workers as independent contractors. And the state of Oregon is right now losing millions of dollars in revenue. It's time we get tougher on crime. And it is a crime. It's a crime against the state of Oregon. And it's good employers and it's good citizens who pay their taxes, who contribute. You know, these schemers and gamers, it's cheaper for them to do the crime and pay a very small fine and go away. So it's time we took a real hard look at this. Misclassification problem really is a black market out there that operates as an underground economy. And it's intended to defeat government regulation and taxation. The most obvious effect of the structured noncompliance with the law is that it costs the federal, the state, and local governments dollars, revenue that you could use to the many social and public service programs that we have in this state. In addition to revenue shortfalls, the employee misclassification problem creates that unfair playing field. Many industries, such as trucking, construction, port container haulers that I'm very familiar with, do this scamming. It's out there. It's bigger than it ever was in this state. And it leaves all law-abiding businesses at a very non-competitive disadvantage out there. On an aside, in this tough time, so you know how we view these things, we're approached by Yellow Trucking, the largest freight line in the United States of America, which is going down the tube. I don't know if you're all aware of that. They approached us last November, and short of bankruptcy, we went to the membership and said, we got to help these employers, this employer. We rolled back $2.27 of employees' wages so that that employer can still be out there. But yet he's faced with that non-competitiveness, that employer that classifies employees as independent contractors and don't pay the taxes. And incidentally, Yellow's still in business. I hope they stay in business. But they still pay their taxes, and they pay them all, the payroll taxes, the unemployment tax, the workman's comp tax. So it's a real problem. Employees who misclassify their workers create problems in the society we live in today by not contributing their fair share of taxes. And again, to the workers' comp, to the unemployment in the state, and also the state and local income taxes. These cheating employers often outbid good employers out there in the construction industry because they have that advantage of not having to pay all the taxes and their reduced labor cost. And beyond the obvious concerns about lost revenues, employee misclassification broaches much broader issues with other laws and regulations. It places an economic burden on employees who are misclassified, as they must, and denies them the right, incidentally, to join a union if they choose to do so. They can't do that. These misclassified employees must pay their own payroll taxes. Now, federal studies, which you have in your package, show that independent contractors only report about 68% of their income. So there's another loss of taxes. Also, if they're hurt on the job, no workers' comp for them, no unemployment benefits, which they're supposed to be legally entitled to. Misclassified employees, again, makes it easier for employers to get around workplace restrictions on hours of work and time. They don't get or receive overtime pay on the job, another advantage to misclassify your employees. Occupational health and safety standards are more difficult to enforce. And that increases the likelihood of workplace injuries. It's rampant among new legal and illegal immigrants who are afraid to challenge the employer because of lack of knowledge of the law, and it forces them to work for much lower wages and benefits if they get any at all. But again, giving that employer who cheats the advantage to go out and take advantage of other employees and other people. Also, the fear of getting deported is always on their mind. Misclassified employees lose out on national and state labor laws that should protect all employees in the workplace. And they're forced to pay for their own safety net benefits like Social Security, Medicare, health benefits, pension, other benefits, which employers normally contribute to, the good employers contribute to. And if they don't provide it, if these misclassified employees as independent contractors don't do that, eventually they become wards of the state because they have no backup. For the most part, misclassified employees make only about 40% of what others in the same industry doing the same job make. Again, where's the justice in it? While the classified, who the employer that misclassifies retains the huge financial windfalls. Employers who properly classify their employees face a 30% tax to cover for the cheaters. So, and I've included additional information there in your exhibits A and B for your perusal at another time, or you can look at them now. But it's past time to stop this abuse of these cheating employers out here. This is a crime. This is against everybody, all the good people out here, all our good employers. And whether they're union or non-union, they're good employers, and they take care of their employees, and they pay their taxes. It just tears me up that we don't pay that much more attention to it. And if these employers don't want to obey the law, let them leave. Get the hell out of Oregon. We've got plenty of good employers, good employees that would be glad to do the work that they're doing. In closing, I'm respectfully asking this committee for an endorsement of this bill. I want you to take a hard look at it. It deserves that. It'll provide that additional revenue to the state of Oregon that's going to help you, not hurt you. I'm talking about additional revenue. And I know that it's tough on people when you say it's a crime. It is a crime. What are the good people worried about? They don't commit the crime. They treat their employees right. They got nothing to worry. They got no fear from this bill. The independent contractor that is the real independent contractor has no fear of this bill. It's not going to harm him or hurt him in any way. So no law-abiding employer or employee should have any fear of what's going on here. And there's no witch hunt going on or nothing out here. We're not going out and turn over the stones and looking for everybody. But it's time we took a hard look at who's doing this. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll conclude my testimony, and I'll be glad to answer any questions you all may have. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Lynn, and I agree with what you said, and it is time to go after these folks. And I don't care if they leave Oregon if they're bad guys either. They can leave. If they don't like the laws, they can go somewhere else and do their business. Because they're hurting workers, they're hurting good employers who we're going to hear from right now. They're hurting this state's ability to raise revenue, to provide services. So I appreciate you bringing this bill. We are going to take a good hard look at it. We are going to work and see what we can do, and hopefully do something that will go after these scoundrels that I don't want in my neighborhood. Mr. Russell, now we're going to hear from the good employers that are doing a good job out there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Russell, president of the Oregon Trucking Associations. Certainly, we wouldn't advocate anybody operating illegally in any way. And we would support strong enforcement of all the legal provisions that govern employers in the state. However, we don't think this is the right bill. And the reason we don't think it's the right bill is that the legislature has worked really hard to synchronize the definition of independent contractors across all the agencies that deal with employees and independent contractors. The 2003 legislature considered Senate Bill 232, which would have synchronized the definition between the Employment Department, Workers' Comp, and the Revenue Department. However, they realized it was a very complex subject, so the result of that bill was the governor's task force that met during the interim between the 03 and the 05 session. They worked really hard when they thought they were done. They came to the governor and said, we can come up with a common definition for employment and for revenue, and it's very close to the federal definition that the IRS uses, but we can't quite figure out how to do it for workers' comp. The governor told them to go back and start again. Finally, they came back with the Attorney General recommending that they only synchronize the definition for employment and revenue and not for workers' comp. So in the 2005 session, the legislature considered and passed Senate Bill 323. And what that bill did was it set up a test to determine if one is an independent contractor or an employee. And it's a five-part test. An independent contractor must be in compliance with three of those five parts. parts to be determined to be an independent contractor. Those points are they have to have a separate business location, they have to bear the risk of loss, they have to provide services for two or more folks, they have to make a significant investment in equipment, plant, whatever, and they have to have the authority to hire and fire their own employees. That definition has been in effect since 2005. As I said, it's very consistent with the federal definition, and it's made life easier for, I believe, employers and independent contractors alike. This bill would change that definition significantly. What this bill the standard that this bill sets up, it says, in making this determination under this section, the Bureau shall find employee status if the control exercised by the party paying remuneration is a general one, exercised directly or indirectly over the physical activities of the individual being remunerated, and need not extend to all the details of the physical performance of the duties performed for the employer. That definition is very, very broad. It's broad enough to drive the proverbial truck through it.
Can do that.
That was subtle, yeah. That was
subtle. We think that folks that are involved in dealing with independent contractors need more direction from the legislature. The legislature, in fact, provided that direction in 2005. And with all due respect to my friend from the Teamsters, we believe that the state should rigorously enforce the current standard, and we would support anything that would do that and help Mr. Lehrbach and his members and the good employers in the state that I represent. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. And definitely, what I like about this is it draws attention to issue that the law is an organic thing, and people use it to and mold it and shape it to their own needs, and sometimes I think it gets a little out of shape, and I definitely want to look into what you just said and the enforcement side of this, and if there's some bad actors out there, I want to put the hammer down on them, and if they're using the law, this language in a way to interpret it to get around something, then I'm upset and I want to do something about it. And once again, the law is an organic thing. It's constantly growing over here and over there. And I don't think it'll ever... I was here with those painful debates on independent contractor, and it's like a lot of other things. The debate constantly rages. It never ends. Clearly, we're going to be back here on regulation of telecom and internet service again, next session, I'm sure, and this is just another thing that we're constantly going to be attending to. But that being said, I definitely share and agree with the sentiments that were expressed by Mr. Lehrbach. I believe there's always somebody out there gaming something. I don't care if it's a trucking company. I don't care if it's a telecom company. I don't care if it's a banker. I don't care. There's always some miserable bustard out there trying to get out of paying their fair share, and that drives me to distraction. Any questions of these good, fine gentlemen?
Representative Holby. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to chime in here because I agree with both the gentlemen sitting in testifying to us today. This is a huge problem. The state of Washington has taken a crack at this, and they're returning a great deal of money to the state by enforcing the laws on worker misclassification. There's other states around the nation that are doing the same thing. This is extremely prevalent in the construction industry, which you're aware of, I'm sure. It is estimated that there's $200 million in lost revenue in the state of Washington just in the construction industry. And, you know, that just a little touch of how big this issue really is. And as the committee administrator knows, I did hold a hearing during the interim on this issue as well as it related to the construction industry. And I had several businesses and contractors come forward and testify, if the state doesn't do something about this, we're going to have to start cheating just like everybody else because we can't stay in business bidding against these guys. You know, we need to take heed
because it not only does it affect the employees missing out on their rightful benefits, but it affects the state and their revenue, and it affects good employers out there that are following the law. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I also thank you. We have also just devastated the Bureau of Labor and Industry's ability to go out and do anything over the years by slashing their budget. I think if we give the Attorney General and the Commissioner the ability to go out and be a little proactive underneath the definition we have today, they could spank and put the hammer down on these bad actors. And that's exactly what we need to do. In the meantime, we have this language before us. Any further questions, these fine gentlemen? All right. Thank you very much for bringing that to our attention. We're going to continue to pursue this over the session.
Thank you.
I know where to
I'll
find
be
you.
Available.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Schultz and Mr. Davey, please. I know you've been waiting patiently and have things to attend to, so come on up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm John Schultz, Administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Thank you for the opportunity to provide some input on a very important public policy issue. Workers' compensation is mentioned in the bill, in the preamble, and in the body of the bill. Workers, just a couple of comments that I think are germane here, is that workers' compensation has a well-established case. We have well-established case law and definitions that relate to many of the issues that are in front of us. Changing the statute always presents some challenges in terms of how do we move forward carefully and preserve what's good in terms of what already exists. So I wanted to make that point, and I think it's important that we move carefully, and I think this issue is a real issue, and it requires careful review and analysis to avoid unintended consequences. Just a couple other points. We would want to be very clear about our role as a regulatory agency if this bill passes. Let me cite an example. DCBS is the state's largest regulatory agency, so we get involved with these issues on a regular basis. In workers' compensation, it's not unusual to run into misclassification of workers, especially in regard to non-compliant employers who are trying to skate through the process without purchasing workers' compensation insurance. And one of the arguments often posed is, well, they're not employees, they're independent contractors or something like that. So my point here is that we would want to be very clear about our role in the wake of this bill. An example that I would share that maybe would illustrate what I'm talking about is just say, for example, we identify a potential misclassification that is leading to loss of tax revenue. In reading the bill, I'm not clear if the expectations for DCBS would change at all. It does appear that I think it would, given BOLI would be provided with additional regulatory responsibilities, it appears that a referral to BOLI of that matter would be important. So working together I think is critical. We don't want to conduct serial audits of employers. I think that creates even further problems. So spending some time and clarifying the various roles that the agencies would have, I think, would be a good thing. Last point that I wanted to make is in Section 4 of the bill, subsection 3A, the bill speaks to the issue of unintentional misclassification by the employer, one of the officers of the employer, or an agent of the employer. Insurers could probably provide a lot more examples than I can, but unintentional misclassification does occur. Usually it's pretty easy to take care of in terms of a premium audit that's conducted by the insurer. What the concern I wanted to raise here is that this bill, even if the misclassification was unintentional, would be either a Class B or a Class A misdemeanor, depending on circumstances. If property and casualty insurance agents working for the employer unintentionally misclassify some of those employees in setting up the insurance policy, it appears that we don't have any flexibility in the bill to provide for different responses other than Class B misdemeanor or Class A. If I could offer one more piece of input on that, over the years, it's been my experience that when the legislature provides options to the regulatory agency, for example, things like responses could include something as simple as educating the employer, especially in the case where misclassification is unintentional. Reprimanding, administrative sanctions could be considered, and also criminal prosecution as well. I think depending on the severity and the number of occurrences. I did want to note that 3B in this same subsection does appear to go in that direction in terms of the more experience a certain employer has doing this sort of thing, the tougher the penalty gets. And with that, I'd be happy to also work with the bill's proponents at any time, and I would be glad to answer any questions that you may have, and I really want to thank you for the opportunity to address you today.
Thank you. Mr. Davey, have you testified already?
No, Chair.
Okay, then go ahead.
Forgive me for getting in and out of here. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Chris Davey with SAFE Corporation. This is also a very important issue for SAFE. We've recently concluded a fairly expensive and long drawn out legal proceeding that resulted in the conviction of an employer for fraud for misclassifying employees and underreporting workers' compensation premiums. However, this bill does raise a whole series of questions. It is all new language that is not allocated to any particular chapter. It doesn't amend any existing statutes, and so it creates potential conflicts between the words of this bill and words that will continue to exist in the statute. It also appears to give jurisdiction to the Bureau of Labor and Industries over some disputes that would be considered to be workers' compensation disputes today, and those are all handled through DCBS, either through the Workers' Compensation Division or the Workers' Compensation Board. So I think the concept is good. It's something that we should be addressing. I'm not sure that this bill in this particular form is going to be the most effective way to do that, but we'd be happy to work with the parties in trying to make it effective and deal with the problem.
Thank you. And before I open to questions, we're going to hear from Bowie in a moment. And There is a problem. I believe there's a problem. You just stated there's clear evidence that there's a problem. And we, I guess what this bill definitely will accomplish is this body is aware of the problem. And now it's our job to help you and the various agencies and departments at the very least go out and do your job. I believe in a proactive way. I know we don't want to do serial audits. I agree with you. That's burdensome and unnecessary. But what I want to get out of this is what can this body and legislature and governor and state government do about that? Because we cannot just say, oh, we had a hearing on that and go away. We have to do something about this, and until I see some evidence of us doing something about it, we're going to continue to hear and work bills like this. And we cannot go away after this session and say, we dealt with that problem with this hearing. It has to be more than this. And how can I help you do that? That's what I want to hear, and that's what I want to talk about. And I really, with that, Representative Edwards.
Real quick question, Mr. Chair. Mr. Davey, you said there was a long, drawn-out, and expensive process that you just went through. Do you have any numbers off the top of your head that you could share with us about how long and how drawn out and how expensive
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I don't have that today. This was a lawsuit that went on for over a year, I think, and ultimately we concluded that this particular employer underpaid workers' compensation premiums over, I'm thinking, maybe a 4 or 5 year period, that it was something like $2 million. Actually, Representative Holby is familiar with that lawsuit and may actually have better numbers than I do.
That agitates me, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, drives me to distraction.
And, Mr. Chair, if I may, I would also add that in addition to the workers' compensation premium that wasn't paid, the assessment on that premium, which helps fund many of the programs at DCBS, like workers' compensation or OSHA, the employer was also avoiding paying that.
Well, we have Ms. Representative Witt and then Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Our committee had testimony the other day on a workers' compensation issue, return to work, and it was alleged that there have been instances in state government where state government probably wasn't operating at a level that we would expect. So I'm concerned that when we write statutes that we expect the best from everyone. And I'm wondering, as both of you would have occasion to be monitoring compliance and whether workers' compensation is adequately paid on behalf of employees, whether in Section 2, the definition of employer would adequately cover public bodies.
Either one of you gentlemen want to respond to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, I really couldn't respond to that right now.
That's okay.
And Mr. Chair, my response is really the same. It's a non-response. I can see your concern there because it does seem to be absent. I would want to pose that question to our counsel over at the Department of Justice.
It's probably an area that, as folks work on this bill, I think, I want to lend my support to the concept completely behind what this bill attempts to accomplish. But I do think, Mr. Chairman, there are several places in this bill where there are discrepancies that may lead to unintended outcomes. This definition could be one of them.
And I appreciate that, and that's exactly what we're doing here. It's relating to classification of employees. If there's something out there that you need in the statute that's going to help you do your job better, I want to put it in here and make it the law. I want to know, I want to find out, and then I want to do it this session. If there isn't, if you're not clear on it, we're going to find out what we need and help you, and then we're going to do it. But clearly, where there's smoke, there's fire. And I think there's a fire raging out there, and I want you all to have the tools, and that might mean money, too. So I just think it's a broad relating clause. if there's something with tools, definition, language we can put in here to help you do your jobs, I want to do it this session, which is in the next couple weeks we need to do something. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Davey, maybe you can help answer. How was this back or lack of payment discovered?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, I actually didn't come here today with all those facts at my fingertips, so I really don't recall how it was discovered. We do premium audits where we go out and check on the payroll that has been reported by employers. We do that on a routine basis. I don't know whether this came out of that. I think this was more of a Department of Justice legal action that encompassed more than just workers' compensation. But I don't remember exactly what the trigger was.
Will you, can you put a summary together on that and share with us?
Yes, I can.
That'd be great.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to, maybe the committee members, as somebody who signs a check for workers' compensation insurance quite often, I get audited every year by my provider. I always thought it was a spot audit, but they always spot me. And I know the insurance companies have a vested interest in making sure this stuff is done correctly, and if there's an accident, that would trigger an investigation if the person wasn't classified right. There's a lot of things out there today, and you know, it'd be interesting to know how that was caught, because you know, sometimes we're going to create new statutes for a problem that, yeah, there's some bad employers out there, but it sounds like in this situation it took a long time, but they got caught. There are things out there today that are keeping honest people honest and catching the crooks too. So I just want to make that clear.
If I could just add something
before, though, I agree with you. But you know what? My saw and my hammer don't do me any good if I can't pull them down off the shelf and use them for some reason. So if there's something we need to do to use those tools he's talking about to help you go after the people that are doing the wrong thing, that's where I'm at. That's really what I think we can at least accomplish out of this bill, whether it passes or not this session. But I agree with you.
Well, Mr. Chair, and if I may, there was a bill yesterday that was heard in a different committee that would help you get your saw and hammer out of the attic if we take a look at it, too.
All right, very good. Yes, I think I know what you're referring to, Representative. You get that to the floor, and I'll vote yes.
Mr.
Okay.
Chair, if I may, I apologize. I don't have the bill number with me, but I will send it over. There is a bill for the Department of Revenue, which would allow them to share information that up to this point they are not allowed to share. And so often when we work with the other agencies, that's a way that we can identify when shenanigans are going on. That barrier, they want to get that barrier removed, and they have a bill for it, and I will forward that bill, identify it, forward it over to the committee administrator.
I'd be more than interested in seeing it. Thank you. Representative Esquivel, then Colby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my colleague Representative Witt brought up a very good point, and we discussed this about government not really catching up with the private sector yesterday. But more importantly, what we found out in veterans is the person that was discriminating the most, believe it or not, in the workforce against veterans was the government. So I agree with Representative Witt. That's real important that we get government nailed in here, because we're not going to talk the talk. If we are, then we better walk the walk.
I couldn't agree more. Any Representative Holby, please.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment that Mr. Davies is talking about that particular case. It's not just workers' comp that was involved in that. It was the Department of Justice, the Employment Department, Revenue, and it wasn't just their money. There was a lot more money involved that was being shorted our state, which could have been used for good services. And there are actually a couple of bills dealing with pieces of this issue that I'm hopeful get through. One of them will cost a little bit of money, but the amount of money that it would return the state would far out
outstrip the cost to the program, and the main issue is it helps level the playing field out there for legitimate businesses out there. So I'm hopeful that those bills continue to move forward, and we get to see them on the floor at some point. And this is another companion to those issues, and I think that there's a lot that could be done. We should continue working on this issue through past this session and into the interim and next session too, because I think it's going to take a while to really get a handle on this.
Thank you, Representative. Any further questions of these guys? All right, thank you very much. I look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you.
Kate Newhall, Tom Gallagher, and Don Booker. Even wrote it in there phonetically for me. Kate, why don't you go ahead?
Thank you, Chair Schaffler, members of the committee. My name is Kate Newhall. I'm here today with the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I'm actually here on behalf of State Labor Commissioner Brad Avakian, who sends his regrets that he can't be here today with you personally to provide this testimony. It is an important issue both for the Labor Commissioner and for Oregon employees, who to their detriment are not always appropriately classified as employees. The Commissioner supports the intent of this legislation and, as you've heard in testimony before, the need to better regulate the underground economy and identify employers who may be misclassifying their employees as independent contractors. And I think my testimony today is going to echo a lot of the testimony that you've heard before you. As you have heard, federal, state, and local governments lose billions of dollars every year in revenue from employers who are intentionally misclassifying employees as independent contractors and who are also increasing the tax burden of other law-abiding and tax-paying citizens and employers. As you know, workers who are improperly classified as independent contractors are deprived of numerous entitlements under law, including receiving minimum wage, Social Security, workers' compensation, and unemployment benefits. In addition to this, employers who misclassify their employees as independent contractors gain a competitive advantage over businesses that are properly classifying employees and paying proper wages and taxes as required by law. The Commissioner does support the concepts contained in House Bill 2890 and instituting a clear statutory mandate to properly classify workers employed as employees. However, the Bureau has identified some technical issues with the current language of the bill that would make its implementation difficult. As the agency that would be charged with enforcing the provisions of this legislation, we would be pleased to work with other affected agencies, the sponsors, and advocates behind this legislation so that the law could be administered and as it is intended. Again, I just want to echo some of the things that have been said here before us and express the Commissioner's support of the intent and substance of this bill and commend those who have brought the proposal before us to address this very, very serious problem. And thank the committee for considering this legislation. And again, we would be pleased to work with the advocates, sponsors, and other affected agencies.
Kate, before I go to Representative Kimmer, I don't need to repeat everything I just said to SAFE and workers' comp, but you, whatever we can do to help Brad or Commissioner Avakian, everyone agrees with the intention. Mm-hmm. Everybody sees the problem. Everybody has problems with the language. I want to find out what we can do to follow up on the intention and accomplish the goal of that intention. Okay. So that's what. And Representative Canterer, please.
Thank you. I wonder, does the Commissioner also support the criminalization of these offenses?
I think that that would be, I think what the Commissioner supports is the better enforcement of the inappropriate classification of employees, and I think that that would be a larger policy conversation that we should have in considering this concept, too.
And I think the case we were referring to, somebody's going to jail on that one with what we have right now.
Oh, yeah.
So, all right. Tom, go ahead. Or Mr. Booker, let's hear these two guys, Representative Cameron, and we'll go to you first.
Thank you, Chair Schaffler and members of the committee. My name is Don Booker. I am the Developmental Disability Specialist for the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. We're waiting for AOC to get back to us on this piece of proposed legislation before AOC MHP takes a, an official position. However, I can share with you that we are concerned about how this bill would affect seniors and people with disabilities, as well as persons with mental health issues who, with state and federal dollars, employ individuals in their homes to prevent their having to leave independent living for a higher, more expensive, and more restrictive level of care. I guess what I'm trying to say is that in the definition section of this bill, it is just too broad. Yes, there are problems in the trucking industry, there are problems in the construction industry, probably other places as well, where the term independent contractor is being manipulated as a tax saving and revenue, other revenue saving issue. However, it seems to us in this bill that you're painting a patch on something with a brush this wide. And we would ask that you consider in the definition that money's channeled through public funding for in-home care be exempted in the definition of independent contractor or something of that sort. These individuals who we're providing funding for are not capable of making these fine decisions of what an independent contractor is, setting up insurance, workers' comp, all these things. We may have an 89-year-old person with early onset Alzheimer's. We've got somebody coming in there 3 hours a day to help them keep their house and get their cooking done and keep their nutrition up. We may have an individual with a developmental disability, perhaps Down syndrome or autism, to use the old phrase, mental retardation. Anyone with an IQ under 70, there are a lot of people out there with IQs under 70 living in their own homes, maintaining the dignity of independent living with some minimal help coming in. Those people are independent contractors, but the way this is written currently, we feel that those people might fall under that category. And that would criminalize the acts of these individuals who are trying to stay in their own homes. So, thank you very much for hearing me.
Thank you. It might make the state the criminal in employing people. So I share your concern, but you know what? I'll tell you, if the state is employing people to provide a service, the state should pay workers' compensation and unemployment insurance and payroll tax.
The state is, according to, I guess, the Attorney General's office, the state is not the employer. The state is simply channeling the funds to the individual as one of their benefits.
It's a fine point.
Just like the state is not the employer of the doctor that the Oregon Mental Health Program or Oregon Health Program pays for.
It's a fine point, and we need to look at it. But I do appreciate your testimony. Mr. Gallagher, and then go ahead.
I'm Tom Gallagher, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, representing the Oregon District Publishers. I think I concur with almost all the testimony ahead of me, especially that our only, if we have an issue, it's only in where the language fits into the statute. There are a couple of exemptions in the statute that have been worked out over a number of years, some federal and some state, for very small numbers of employees. The ones I'm talking about are 2005 are called newspaper stringers. Person who writes your garden column in the paper. I think what the committee is focused on are people who are taking bigger economic abuses of the system. If the language is crafted in such a way that we don't want to revisit some of those small, very long, involved details that went into definition of independent contractor, you would be able to focus on the hard points. That's my only comment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Cameron.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you, Kate, for coming and on behalf of the commissioner. On your testimony here, I just wanted to be clear, including receiving minimum wage, Social Security benefits. if somebody's an independent contractor, they're still paying self-employment tax, correct?
Yes.
So they wouldn't be denied Social Security benefits?
No.
Okay. You might want to clarify that in your testimony.
Unless the person has been inappropriately classified and isn't aware of that, and they're not paying the appropriate taxes as an independent contractor.
So they would be committing fraud, tax fraud.
That's true, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions of this panel this morning? All right, thank you very much. Alex from Lane County. I'm sorry, I can't read your last name. Forgive me. Oh, thank you, Mr. Kyler. I just met you yesterday. And Jim Craven, why don't you come on up, too? And that's all I have on the list, so if anybody wants to testify after these gentlemen are done, let me know. I'll get you up here. Go ahead, Mr. Kyler.
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, I am Alex Kyler. I'm the Intergovernmental Relations Manager for Lane County. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. Just very briefly, and appreciate the comments of Representative Witt and Representative Esquivel regarding public agencies, but to the bill itself, as written, the county, Lane County, did have some concerns with the definition of employer, and the reason I'm here is to speak to that section of this printed bill. We'd be happy to engage in a conversation moving forward to have any sort of scrutiny over how we employ contractors within the local government of Lane County, but to this bill, we'd ask that there would be an exclusion for public employer as it's defined in other areas of statutes. And that concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Craven representing Tech America. I guess I get to back clean up here. At the risk of, in 2003, when we were discussing this in the legislature, I think I came up and made some comments, and I wound up in an interminable set of meetings for the next 18 months during the task force that brought the bill to the legislature in 2005. So with that disclaimer, I don't want that to happen again, but just a couple of comments here. I think you've really heard most of the points I was going to make. That this, really, I think what you're trying to get at is enforcing current law. I mean, we spend a ton of time writing current law about defining independent contractor and trying to align with federal law and all that. So I would not focus on this new definition, which really is in total conflict with current law. And so I think your challenge, what you're trying to get at, is how do we enforce current law? At least I think that's what I've heard today. Not start over with the definition of independent contractor, because I think we did that pretty well. How do we enforce the law that we adopted in 2005 in a better way? I think sounds to me where you're heading, and I would endorse that. So I think there are some big hammers in this bill. You've heard of the creation of a crime for what sometimes can be an honestly complicated process. But there's also elements in here. There's debarment from public contracting for a series of years. There is an interesting provision for a stop work order. You've misclassified an employee. The way I read it, bully can come in and shut your company down and then put you subject to multiple years of supervision, class action lawsuits. There's a lot of interesting elements in this bill, but I think there's also a real kernel of something that probably is worthwhile working on. Take the current system, take all the work we did in 2003 in the interim and 2005, the definition, figure out how to better enforce it. Part of the complication right now, and I'm not an expert on this system, is that you have sort of individual agency enforcement. You know, revenue has the ability to go after people. Employment division has certain abilities. Workers' comp has certain abilities. So sort of overlaying BOLI and the determinations of facts in each one of those cases, I would think, would probably remain with those agencies. I mean, revenue understands revenue law. Workers' comp understands workers' comp. This bill seems to say that BOLI would sort of make independent judgments in these cases, and I think that needs to be wrestled with. So anyway, thank you for the chance to testify.
And thank you. And believe me, I remember the painful work we did and the debate that raged. And but the thing is, okay, we have this definition, we worked a lot on it, and we came to that conclusion, but we're not enforcing it at the level we need to. once we do increase that enforcement, I believe something will come out showing us why the definition needs to be maybe tweaked a little bit, because clearly maybe the definition doesn't meet whatever it is we need to do this. And then on the civil criminal, there's a lot of areas in law, if I'm not wrong, Counselor, where there's a civil process and a criminal process, depending on the degree of the offense. So I don't have any problem with having a criminal part. I believe there should be a civil for the inadvertent stumbler bumbler like me out there. I don't think I deserve to go to prison if I make a mistake. Matter of fact, I don't think there should even be a civil penalty for a honest inadvertent mistake. That being said, if you refuse to show up to the hearing repeatedly, slap a civil penalty on them. If they don't follow up on that, then you go after in the criminal court. So I think there's a process that could be added that could include, and the case we talked about earlier, somebody's going to jail and they belong in jail. So I'm not going to dismiss the criminal side of this concept here. Any questions of these fine gentlemen? Thank you very much. Have a good weekend. Michael Dale is the last one on the list. And if there's anybody else, speak now or hold your peace till next time. Oh, come on up. Yes, please. Just for future reference, we usually have a sign-up sheet out there. Just put your name on. We'd love to have you. Go ahead, Michael.
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, my name is Michael Dale. I'm the executive director of the Northwest Workers Justice Project. The Northwest Workers Justice Project represents low-wage workers, particularly in what we call contingent employment, which is often employment that's mischaracterized or misclassified as independent contractor relationship. So we're very, very familiar with the problems that are being addressed here. It is a huge problem, and I speak to support the concepts behind the bill. I would only add one thought, and that is that aside from the criminal process, aside from the agency process, another way that these laws can be enforced is by the workers who are misclassified and who are injured in their direct assertion of their rights to proper payment of minimum wage, overtime, and so forth. I think that there are some things that could be done to tighten the definitions in Oregon law of the employee that would be of assistance. Most of my 30 or so years of experience as an employment lawyer has been in the area of who's an employee and who is not under different laws. And if there are further committee deliberations with respect to this, I would offer to be of whatever assistance I could to the committee or the agencies or whoever is participating to try to tighten up those laws. Thank you.
Remember, thank you in the debate. I don't remember if it was Mr. Shipracker who said the story, but when a worker fell off the roof somewhere between the eave of the building and then when they hit the ground, they became an independent contractor. So, go ahead, please.
Hi, my name is Maggie Kroll, and this is Sarah Knight, and we are representing. I expected there to be some representatives of DHS and seniors with seniors and people with disabilities, and I know that Mr. Booker spoke to this a little bit. We represent support services brokerages. We provide support services to adults with disabilities who live in the community, and we contract directly with DHS to do that as agencies, as private agencies. It's part of our job to create capacity to support these folks to live in the community. We help qualify employees that can work in people's homes, domestic employees, and we help qualify independent contractors. It's our job to perform a weight test that Mr. Russell referenced earlier that came out of the 2005 session about determining whether a person is more appropriately classified as an employee or as an independent contractor. Some of the unintended consequences that I think this can bring for support services, and we represent over 7,000 people, soon to be probably 10,000 people. All adults with disabilities are entitled to this service. If not, 24-hour care is also an option for them, but those are the only two options. Currently, several brokerages have ceased using independent contractors due to threat of either litigation from the Employment Department or from independent contractors. So those services have, in essence, gone away for those people. They don't have an option to contract with people to provide professional skills training. It's not an option. And in the metro area, which is where Sarah and I both work, we represent almost 3,000 people who use independent contractors that were classified in good faith. If Sarah and I are found to be guilty of a misdemeanor, our entire agency cannot contract with the state to provide these services, and that would happen to each brokerage that would occur. So we would be debarred from public contract. The state would be at threat of additional litigation from the litigants of the Staley Agreement. So there's a lot of scary stuff that can happen with the way this language is written. So I would ask you to consider that.
And the value of the language is it got here to come here and talk to us about this. That's the value of some strong language in a bill that's being heard. Whether that language becomes a law or not, it creates this conversation. So, and
sure.
I don't think anyone wants that scenario to unfold, by the way. Go ahead, Ms.
Thank you. My name is Sarah Knight. I represent Inclusion. We're a support services brokerage, one of 13 in the state that serves over 7,000 people with disabilities in the state. And I just kind of want to add to what Maggie has said, that we absolutely take our responsibility to properly classify employees and independent contractors very seriously. We're in a little bit of a difficult position because of the lack of clarity or direction from the Department of Human Services and SPD and the Employment Department, the way our Oregon administrative rules that govern the services we provide are written, are in conflict with how the Employment Department kind of sees our services. So we just, I think this bill impacts services for people with disabilities in some unexpected ways, and so we just wanted you to consider the language and how it's going to impact.
Thank you. I appreciate your
thank you.
Also
yes,
counties and Oregon, the vocational rehabilitation, they all use this model of support services, mm-hmm. So it would impact all of those.
All right. Thank you. Any questions of these folks? All right, I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend. Anyone else want to testify on House Bill 2890? All right, with that, close the public hearing. Anything for the order?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
When we were talking about this whole misclassification of employees, it came to mind that you kept talking about dragging your saw and your hammer down, and I thought you were into laborers.
I'm a licensed general contractor. My license is inactive. I would have to provide proof of insurance if I were to go out and advertise and take on any contracts. But yes, I am a proud former member of the best working trade union in the world. That would be the laborers. Thank you for that question, Mr. Carpenter. If there's anything else for the good of the order. All right, we're adjourned. Have a good weekend.